Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Please enjoy this Legends of Sport classic with Mr. 900 himself, Tony Hawk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's version of Legends of Sport, the podcast. Really happy to be here with my buddy Jonas. What's up, boy?
Andy, my man. All's good.
Yeah, and Sean in the booth, as usual, doing something in there. I don't know what's happening.
Volume knobs.
Oh, volume knobs. This week it's volume knobs. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got you. We are coming to you today with a wonderful guest, truly a pioneer, the godfather of modern-day skateboarding, and all things skating, the great Tony Hawk. And got to throw a shout out to my good friend, your good friend too, Atiba Jefferson, who stayed with Tony and tried to get Tony to come into the studio with us. And today, lo and behold, he came in.
That's right. Yeah, when Tony started his career, it was really still just kind of subculture. It was a thing that, you know, kids who were, I hate to use the word outcasts, but a lot of kids who were outcasts wound up skating. And by the time he was done with his 20-year career, it was really mainstream. Hollywood movies, commercials, they were all using skateboarders. And now you look at the X Games and how it's an international success over the last 20 years. It's really a large part due to Tony being such an incredible ambassador.
For sure. Sport. I mean, skateboarding is going to be in the Olympics. I mean, who could have possibly ever imagined that?
2020.
It reminds me a little bit of like beach volleyball, you know, which was like a subculture in Southern California. People used to go to the beach volleyball tournaments in Manhattan Beach just to go to the bikini contest. And then they actually had a, you know, an actual volleyball thing going on the side, you know. And now look what happened to that. And, of course, it became an international sport and an Olympic sport.
People were going to skating contests for the bikini contest, too.
They probably were, yeah. And I remember when I first moved out here in 78, my brother was about 8 years old, and I used to take him to the skate park in the marina, a very famous skate park. And there would be, you know, 50, 60, 70 kids out there just going off the sides of these ramps and pools, and used to scare the crap out of me because I needed to know where, like, the nearest emergency room was to bring my brother because I knew the kid was just going to kill himself. But he didn't, and he loved it, and I actually photographed him in the pool a couple of times when he was that age, and it was a lot of fun for us as brothers having an adventure, something I didn't grow up with in New York. Mm-hmm. It was such an L.A., California kind of thing. And so thrilled to have Tony come in the studio today, and we will we'll be back with you on the backside. Hope you enjoy it.
When was your first time in L.A., by the way?
First time in L.A.?
Yeah. Can you remember coming up here the first time?
Wow. With my parents? Hmm. I remember my dad was really – he was into the history of like Hollywood and things like that, and he took me to some like drugstore where they said, oh, this is where Shirley Temple got found or recognized. And to me it was like this amazing, you know, fantastical place, and I went and like – got a Sunday at the – I don't even know. I just remembered like – to me it was like this magical world because my dad said it was Hollywood. And right. Then eventually I learned that that's one in a million. And
right.
You got to work your way up.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this quote you said in your autobiography from 2000. Great book. Skating is all about what happens when you skate, which I think kind of
personifies what skating's all about. Can you just kind of expound on that, what you meant by that?
I can't remember that exact quote, but I think for me it's more about actions speaking louder than words. And when skating, you do it in your own style. You do it in your own voice. I mean, it's difficult, and yes, there is competition, but for the most part, it's just an artistic expression. So it's about how you present your skating, how you do your skating is how you present yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think there's this misconception with people who don't know about skating and people who are in competition, skateboarders, that there's, you know, it's like any other sport where, you know, people are rooting against you. But that's not the case, right?
Not really. It's so hard to liken it to anything. The best analogy people have made is with ice skating, but even ice skating has such strict rules about what you can and can't do and what should be judged and what shouldn't and how you do it. Yeah. Skating is just freeform, and it's very irreverent. And so I don't like comparing it to anything else, and it's art against art. So sure, someone has a great day and maybe someone else's style you like better, but by the end of it, it's just a matter of your opinion. And it doesn't really – there's no fastest runner. There's no highest jumper. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how you – like what art did you create in that 1 minute time you had? And so I love it. And I love that we've managed to navigate competition even with that set of non-rules.
Yeah. Mm. Did you think when you started your career so early that you'd have a 20-year career?
No. When I started skating, you were basically done when you reached an adult age, when you were out of high school, because no one could make a living at it. So you had to find a job.
Yeah.
And so it was like you were as serious as you could get until you're aged 18 to 20. And then after that, you're washed up.
And you had to make a living somehow.
You had to make a living, yeah. And even then, people weren't really improving their skills past that age because they just were told they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was when I remember vividly seeing a photo of a guy in a magazine when I was 20-ish. And it was a guy and he was 30 doing a hand plant. And the caption was like, still going for it at 30. And in my head, I was thinking, wow, that's crazy.
Like this guy's over the hill.
Yeah. Or just that he's still doing it that age. Like that's great, you know.
Yeah,
and then,
I didn't think I'd be doing what I'm doing at 30 either. No, I'm kidding. But definitely not at 60, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, ancient.
I was saying this guy just got inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Naismith NBA Hall of Fame.
Oh, awesome.
A couple weeks ago in Springfield. And
congratulations.
Thank you.
He's right back on the baseline taking pictures for the Lakers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Pretty amazing.
Just very cool.
Still doing what I'm doing, man. You know? Got tuitions to pay and
starting the LeBron era.
Too many kids in the house, you know.
This guy's awesome. In Andy Bernstein 4.0 right now. Is this Tony Hawk 3.0? Where do you consider this?
Oh, wow. Life? I never really considered that.
I could chop up your career, I feel like.
I would say, stage one was definitely into my teens with the success of the 80s. Stage two was sort of navigating not making an income with it as a young adult with a child on the way.
Uh-huh.
Stage three was having a renewed success through X Games, video games, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'd say this is 4.0. This is me into middle age trying to figure out how to stay in it, maybe stay relevant, but also effective and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, Tony, tell us, who influenced you along the way? I mean, not just in skating, but now that you've transitioned, you're a businessman, you're a tycoon in the industry, you literally created a culture. There had to be somebody along the way on the business side that helped you develop your vision and then get it to move forward.
Yeah, I think my inspiration for starting a company was Stacy Peralta, because Stacy Peralta was our skate coach for 10 years on the Bones Brigade, and he was the one who broke out and did it on his own. He was a sponsored skater in the 70s for GNS, which was like the prominent company then, and then he chose to create his own company, Paul Peralta, and form the Bones Brigade. Mm. So the irony of doing that is that once we came to an age where we wanted to maybe have our own thing, we took our cues from him and left his company to start our own thing. Well, a couple of us did, and I was one of them.
And how did that go over with him?
He was supportive, but yeah. He said that, like, how could I tell you no? It's exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So he was supportive, and mm-hmm. and yeah, that was the but in terms of navigating business after that, I didn't really know what I was doing. I had a business partner who was also a pro skater, but had a business degree, so he gave me definitely the right pointed me in the right direction, and kept our business flowing. Even when things were tough. After that, I don't know. It was just more intuition.
That's interesting. Yeah, because, I mean, I kind of went on my intuition for a long time. But then to get to the next level and to kind of develop whatever dreams I had or goals I was trying to develop, I had to find people who knew what the hell they were doing in business. You know, I could barely balance a checkbook, for God's sake. So, you know, I sought out guys like Peter Guber or his partner Paul Schaefer or Patrick Soon-Shiong, guys like that who were in my sort of stratosphere around the NBA. Norm Pattis, who owns, you know, Podcast One, is one of my great mentors, great friends. So the fact that your intuition took you to these like next levels to me is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think being intuitive too about who to connect with and who to form bonds with as well, and people whose business whose business ethics that I respected.
Yeah, and there's a lot of trust there, right? Because people were probably coming at you left and right because skating had taken off, the culture, and of course the fashion, the music industry, and I'm sure people were hitting you up left and right. Like,
yeah, a lot of strange licensing deals were offered in those days, for sure.
I bet. And how did you vet those out? Was it all just sort of
It was just more if I felt like it was connected to skateboarding closely enough, or if I felt like it was something that I either participated in or that I felt strongly about. Mm-hmm. If it was just – there was no fit, I just would let it go.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hear you. I got you.
Yeah, you know, skating was this offshoot of kind of board surfers who were looking for their next wave and, you know, doing sidewalk surfing. And, you know, Stacy really, I think, talks about this elegantly in Dogtown and Z-Boys. Is that, you think, the preeminent documentary about skateboarding? I mean, is there?
I think it's a good. It's a really good take on how skating evolved from this sort of fad toy, pirouette sort of dancing device into something that was much more what we like to call extreme or action sports oriented. That was more risky. That was more exciting with the Dogtown crew that was skating pools. I mean, that is why I started skating. I liked riding my skateboard, but with all the pirouettes and the spins and stuff, I wanted to fly. Like, those guys were flying, that's why I decided to start skating. Yeah.
He was a great talent scout, it seems like. I mean, I know you were a superstar when you were a kid. I mean, we should go back for a second, because I know when you were a baby, you were hyperactive and, you know, you were rambunctious, and your parents were clearly looking for
rambunctious would be a generous term. Yeah.
But your parents had you in their 40s. Your father was 45. Yeah. Your mother was 43. Your father was this decorated war hero in World War II in the Korean War. He was a gold star and won medals, and I mean, which obviously runs in your family, in your blood. Mm-hmm. And your mother was this intellectual. She got her doctorate in her 60s and her master's degree in her 50s. I mean, you were not a dumb kid. You had 141 IQ.
So, yeah, but I think it was just it was exactly that. I always expected more of myself and demanded more of myself. And in the sports I was participating in, I just wasn't big enough to make a splash in terms of basketball or baseball. I was a runt. And then when I found skating, I found this way to style my skating that worked with my body size, that allowed me to be creative and get noticed. Not easily, but get noticed because the scene was so small and the stuff I was doing was so different. Even though in a lot of ways I got ridiculed for it. Stacy was one of the first person. I mean, Stacy was one of the first people that actually took me aside and said, "Hey, what's going on? Like, how are you liking skating? Or, you know, do you want to follow this as a career?" And I was 12. Career,
right?
I want to keep skating, but I knew who Stacy was, and you know, if anything, I had this huge reverence for him, and the fact that he even acknowledged me gave me a huge boost of confidence.
Right, he was a world champion. He was one of the best skaters in the world. In
he was one of the best,
right?
but by that time, what I knew him as was the best curator of a skate team because his team was the best.
Yeah.
And you wanted to be part of the team?
Or I didn't really like I didn't think I was worthy of that. Mm. So I had a sponsor. I was sponsored by Dogtown as Dogtown was very quickly going out of business. And so I thought I was set. Yeah. I thought I had a good sponsor and I was on a decent team, but Powell was, you know, they were the elephant in the room. They were the biggest, best team. And I just didn't think that I was qualified to be on that team. And then eventually Stacy called me and said, I heard Dogtown went out of business. Mm-hmm. And I said, maybe that's why I'm not getting skateboards anymore.
Yeah.
I only had one contact and they weren't calling me. So that was it. You know, I was very young.
Yeah. And you couldn't make money on sponsorship back then. The only way you could make money was on boards, right? Board sales. And you get like 5%, 2%, whatever it was on each
basically
board.
You were getting about a dollar per skateboard sold.
Yeah. Your first check was like 85 cents. Right?
I got a check for 85 cents. I got another check for $4.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Really?
But at the same time, like I said, there was no dream of being rich or famous from skateboarding because no one had done that.
Yeah.
So, it was just exciting to have that validation that someone wanted to put a skateboard out with your name on it.
Yeah.
That was super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then eventually that became a huge income unexpectedly.
I would think at that age, you know, have your name on a skateboard. I mean, you know, the chicks are seeing that. Everybody, your buddies are seeing it. It's pretty cool though, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure
the girls that were seeing it were sisters of skaters. But,
right.
But it was a blast. And I don't know. Yeah. But in terms of, I lost my train of thought. The biggest prize money that you could hope for, so the only other way to make money was on prize money.
Mm-hmm.
It was $100 for first place at a competition that happened once every 2 months.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But for a 13, 14-year-old, I was banking. I remember my bank account reached $600 when I was 15. And then I was getting to the age of driving. I think I had $1,500 in the bank.
Yeah.
And I bought a car.
Mm.
That was massive.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I bought a car from my income from skating. Mm. To me, that was it.
That was the Honda,
the top of the hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bought that from your parents?
1977 Honda CVCC.
They painted it red down in Mexico?
My dad, My dad went and had it painted red for like $50.
So your parents, were they supportive when you first got the passion? When you first got the bug? Were they supportive? Were they taking you
they
around
were, to competitions? They were, but I think the saving grace was that I was so young. Mm. They didn't think it was a career.
Yeah. They just thought it was like a
if I had chosen that at age 18 as I'm graduating high school, maybe that would have gave them more pause.
Yeah, right. It was kind of like that with me with photography. You know, I started when I was 14, and it was just like give them something to do and put them over there so we'd have to deal with them kind of thing, you know.
Right.
And it became like the thing I wanted to do.
But was – for both of you, was it a eureka moment? When you got your first skateboard from your brother, I think you were 9 or something. Was that like, this is it?
Not at all, no.
No. What about for you when you got your first camera?
Well, first of all, I never skateboarded because it always scared the hell out of me. And I'm the biggest chicken ever. I did play street hockey, so, that, you know, it's close.
But when you got your first when you got your first camera?
No, I got my first camera, and I made that trip with my dad that I've talked about with you when I was 14. And then I saw that I could actually – something in my head could produce something, you know, tangible. It was cool, you know, so, and it actually got validation from my dad from that. Like, he actually looked at the pictures and said, wow, you might have some talent.
So
that was pretty cool.
Was that the same with you? I mean, your dad was generations older than you, and you wouldn't really think that a war hero would be like the cool dad. But your dad, Frank, was kind of like the cool dad. I mean, he was
the most supportive. Yeah, I don't know if cool would be the right label, especially back then.
Yeah.
But for sure, my friends, especially ones whose parents were not supportive of their skating, were excited that my dad would actually embrace them and drive them to the skate park. And he used to set up carpools where we knew there'd be a contest coming up at a skate park in LA. We lived in San Diego.
Yeah.
And then he would say, all right, be at this skate park in San Diego at 8 a.m. on Saturday, and we're all driving to Reseda.
Mm, mm.
And then he would take his truck that had a camper top, and we would all pile in and go to Reseda.
That's a cool dad.
In those moments, especially with the actions, he was very cool.
Yeah.
He was gruff. He was difficult. Yeah. He rubbed people the wrong way. He was in the Navy.
Yeah.
Right.
But
Yeah.
But he was very cool in that he supported his kids. And I think it was because he didn't have that kind of support when he was a kid, for sure, in a lot of ways the exact opposite. But also, I had three siblings before me. And so he had kind of been through everything with kids in the 70s. And by the time I came along, it was like, just keep him busy.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Like, whatever makes him happy, go
the
let
same
him do it.
I was the same way. Yeah. It's like, with, give him the camera. He's busy. He's in the dark room. I don't know what the hell he's doing there, but whatever.
Yeah, and he knew if I could get a ride to the skate park after school, I would be happy there until dark, at least.
But I don't think a lot of people realize your dad's impact on the sport of skateboarding. I mean, with the NSA, he was designing half pipes. I mean, he sounded like a guy who could literally build a house out of this piece of wood.
Yeah, no, he was definitely he was a handyman for sure. He what he saw was such a lack of organization. Right when I got really into skating, all the competition series were failing and going away. And so every once in a while there'd be an event, but it was always a one-off at some skate park. And then he said, you know, we really should start an organization. And he got a lot of the companies to agree to support an organization that would be sanctioning events, and that's how he started the National Skateboard Association.
You know, you were always really hard on yourself as a kid. Is that something that is good about skateboarding? There's nobody else to blame but yourself when you screw up?
Yeah. Is that good? I think so. I think it teaches you a lot about self-discipline, and a lot about confidence, self-confidence, in terms of, if you're going to get better at it, you're the only one that's going to make it happen. It's not because some coach is hounding you to train. And the amount of perseverance skateboarding takes, I think, in a lot of ways, is much more than many other sports. Because you've got to try stuff over and over, hundreds and hundreds of times, maybe just to make one. But when you make that one, it's like no other feeling.
There was also, I think, a lot of perseverance just to be in the skateboarding world for decades when, you know, you've talked about this, that it, you know, it seems to get popular and then like 9 years later the sport dies and then it revives itself. And, you know, that was the case in the mid-60s, you know,
right.
Jan and Dean, everybody pick up a board. And then, you know, when you started, when you were a kid in 79, I think it just stopped, like these, like Oasis skate park in Del Mar.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it died because they were either charging too much or
mostly it was insurance.
Oh,
it was liability insurance. Yeah, it was in the early 80s. Everyone was so happy, and everyone wanted to blame everyone else for getting hurt, and skate parks just couldn't survive that their premiums were so high.
Were all your friends just falling by the wayside? Your local friends stopping skating while you were?
I only had a few friends that skated, and they weren't that serious about it anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of my neighborhood, I found my community at the skate park, even though it was just this ragtag crew of people from all walks of life, different ages and whatnot, but we shared this common interest and we shared the same sensibilities of sort of do-it-yourself attitude, punk music, and I just found my crew there. So once I found that, I wasn't really worried about fitting in at school anymore.
Yeah.
And then when the skate parks closed, I got very lucky that my parents moved to a different part of San Diego. By pure chance, they already owned an apartment there, and that was near one of the last remaining skate parks of the U.S. in the early 80s, was Del Mar Skate Ranch. There were a handful of skate parks across the United States back then.
And the manager there, Grant Britton, he became a Hall of Fame skateboard photographer.
Yeah, Grant. Well, he was just documenting what we were doing and got an interest in photography through there. But he was the pro shop manager, yeah.
That's so wild to me.
That is amazing.
What, you know, you talk about punk music, and I know you talked about listening to Los Angeles by X.
Right.
The first time you heard that song, 1980, at a skate park.
Yep.
What?
Marina Skate Park, Marina Del Rey.
Yeah, my brother used to go there. I moved out here in 78. My brother was 10. You know, he was 9 or 8 or something. But I used to take him there. The Marina Skate Park right there at the end.
That's where the Dogtown Z-Boys sort of, you know, started honing their skills.
Yeah, that was fun. I loved doing that.
What type of music was influencing you back then?
That was it. That was the soundtrack of the skate parks. And I loved it because it was raw, it was energetic, it was fast, and it was different. And I was already feeling different because I was a skater. So to have a music that identified with that movement was perfect for me.
Yeah.
Before that, it was, you know, it was like Foreigner and Journey and 70s music. And
oh, you weren't like the T-Rex guy and the
I was too young to really understand all that. I learned about all that through skating.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. And all those influences, and it definitely shaped my future musical interests.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, everyone. It's Andy Bernstein. You may know me from my Hall of Fame career as a sports photographer. Well, just like you, we all want to take great photos of our sports, travel, or family. To take great photos, you need great camera equipment and a great store. Paul's Photo has what you need, and they have what I need. The team at Paul's Photo can help you choose the right camera and teach you how to use it. Paul's Photo. Call them at 310-375-7014 or find them 24/7 online at paulsphoto.com. Paul's Photo, your local camera store, no matter where you live.
What was your first big trick?
Big trick?
Yeah, or your first trick that
the first trick that I ever did that was new was a backside varial, which is basically you reach down, grab the board, and turn it 180 under your feet. Yeah. It had only been done frontside before that. Mm-hmm. By a guy named Eric Grisham. He named it after his sponsor, Veriflex. Mm-hmm. So it was the varial. And I figured out how – I couldn't do it frontside. First of all, my frontside arrows suck. So I learned how to do it backside about halfway up the pool wall. And that was my big trick for the amateur – like the unsponsored amateur events. That was my big last trick.
Yeah.
But it was the first – it was the first time where I thought, I can create something new.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is incredible. Like skating is this empty canvas and I can do whatever I want. And I made up a trick.
Right. Yeah. But you were little back then. You're 6 foot.
I was super little,
you're 6 foot three.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
4'11", 85 pounds.
But that's what I'm saying. I wasn't even near the top of the pool. I was halfway up the pool.
And that's why you thought about doing that trick. Was that it? Like the laws of physics.
Yeah, I couldn't get the speed to do the big handstands and the big aerials and stuff. So I had to figure out how I can maneuver my board at the limited height that I had.
So you're just adapting, trying to figure it out until you –
yeah, so that's
better.
How I learned all the shove-it stuff, all the varial stuff, wow. Because of my size.
But, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you have to be absolutely fearless, right, to do this sport? I mean, as a child, were you fearless?
I wasn't fearless, but I wasn't afraid to get hurt.
Okay, all right.
And I think that's the – because the idea that you're fearless and throwing caution in the wind, that only goes so far with skateboarding. You got to have the foundation, the skills to back up what you're trying. Mm-hmm. But the first time I ever got hurt severely was I was about 11. I fell doing a rock and roll in the pool because my board was huge and because I didn't know how to get on top. And I got a concussion. I knocked my front teeth out. Mm. They found me on the bottom of the pool.
Hey.
And I remember very vividly waking up in the ambulance and not thinking like, what have I done? Oh, my God, I'll never skate again. But my first thought was, well, I got to figure out how to do rock and rolls better.
Oh, huh.
I would call that fearless. I mean, it's just
so not
fearless.
But it was just more. It was more a conviction.
Right.
That I want to. This is what I want to do. I don't care. Like, right. I'll get new teeth. That really was my thought. Like, I'm going to keep doing this.
So wait a minute. So fast forward.
But I feel like a lot of people. That's their.
Yeah.
That's the line of demarcation. That's when they say, I'm not doing this ever again.
Right.
I got hurt.
Right. 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 But I got to know, fast forward, and I know we'll get to this, but your son Riley, I mean, watching him, you know, at that age that you were, I mean, I would just be cringing as a father. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, my God, is he going to survive that, whatever he's doing?
Yes and no. I feel like he has a very good sense of his limitations, and he likes to push those boundaries, but he doesn't go crazy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I have another son that does go crazy with it, and he definitely tests my –
yeah, really.
Because he throws caution to the wind.
Oh,
he doesn't. And he used to skate. He skates. He's a good skater.
How old is he now?
He's 17 now.
Okay.
Is it Spencer?
Or
is
that Keegan?
Keegan.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was always the ball of fury. But
wow.
But he finally got his skills and the foundation to do this stuff, and now I feel better about it. Mm. But like he would, when he was, I don't know, 10 years old and barely skating, dropped in on the mega ramp, the 30-foot ramp.
Yeah.
Just dropped in. Didn't know what he was like, going to do on the other side. Didn't know what he was going to do the speed, but he did it.
Oh my That's God. Hardcore.
Wow.
Yeah, well, and so that kind of stuff really was frightening to me to watch because I just knew he didn't care.
Right. Well, it's in the genes.
And now that you're an ambassador of the sport, you know, we're hearing more and more about concussions in football and hockey. Is skateboarding doing anything in that arena to –
Well, research, for sure.
Yeah.
I've done my own research, to be honest, just because I've had multiple concussions through my life, and I want to know what risk I have and what the effects of that would be or could be, or am I susceptible to, you know, this degenerative brain disease and stuff like that. But, you know, skateboarding will be in the Olympics in Tokyo, and the
how crazy is that? By the
it's
way,
wild.
I mean,
it's
you sitting here
that's
saying that skateboarding is going to be in the Olympics.
You were influential in making that happen.
Yeah,
I've been a little bit on the sidelines as of yet. I might be getting more involved, but I'm still cautious about what's happening with it because I just don't really understand all of the red tape of and what it takes. Mm-hmm. But I do know that the World Skate Organization is taking head injuries very seriously, and they have done these studies, and they have a protocol in place already for their events. And I'm not trying to defend anyone with what goes on, but I do know that I've seen the communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we spoke to Mike Smith, the horse jockey, won the Triple Crown with Justify, and he said something that kind of resonated. I'm just thinking about it now. It's not if you're going to fall off the horse; it's when.
Yeah.
So is that something
Absolutely.
That's taught in skateboarding? How to fall so that you could maximize longevity in your career? Because you can.
Is it taught? I can't say it's taught. I think it's learned by default.
Yeah.
And everyone has a different way of doing it. The type of skating I do with big ramps, vert skating, and pool skating, there is a technique to getting out of a situation safely by sliding on your knees. Mm-hmm. And that is something that if people don't skate vert a lot but are good skaters, you have to teach them that mindset. Mm-hmm. Because when you see a guy who is used to skating street and doing things like that, and they go up on a vert ramp and they fall, they're just flailing in the air and trying to run. And, and you get so much speed with that descent.
Yeah.
That generally you can't run out of it. So that's something that you have to teach them. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of an anomaly.
Yeah.
If you choose to do vert skating, very quickly you're going to learn how to knee slide, and that's how it's going to go.
Yeah. You know, speaking about your career for a second, I mean, I think a lot of people think that you lived this charmed life during your pro career, that everything was peaches and cream. You were showing up on the cover of, you know, a teenager, Thrasher magazine, skateboard magazine. But I don't think a lot of people realize that when the sport died again in the early 80s, I think you were in your 20s, your salary.
Early 90s. Early.
Your salary just kept cutting in half.
Yeah.
Every year. And
every month. Not every year.
Yeah. And you excuse me, but you were, you know, at a point in your career where you were trying to figure out how to pay the mortgage. You had to you know, sell your house. Your wife at the time, I think, was making more than you as a manicurist.
Yeah.
And you were on like a $5 a day Taco Bell allowance.
I was on one of those. Yeah.
I'm on that now.
Yeah. You know what? Back then, though, $5 went a long way at Taco
Bell. Yeah, you could actually get
two bean and cheese burritos and a big soda. Yeah,
you could do okay now, too. Still one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But that must have brought – because I know there were times along that route you were thinking about retiring because you had won the NSA 10 years in a row, I mean, unprecedented. And I don't know if you were burnt out or what, but you were certainly trying to figure out what to do if this didn't last, right? Did you come back to the love of skateboarding at that point where it was I'm not skating for anybody else except myself?
Yeah, I always did love it. It definitely gave me more time to focus on skating and not training for events per se. Or being conservative with how I skated, because when you are competing nonstop, you do tend to get in this mode where you're only doing tricks you know you're going to make, and you're making up routines that are pretty solid and consistent. And when you're stripped of that, there's a lot of freedom. It's more liberating. My skating improved drastically, but to a much smaller audience.
Yeah.
So that was a weird that was where a byproduct, but I wasn't ever doing it because of the audience. Mm-hmm. I was doing it because I really did love the progression of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it definitely taught me that I love skating and I want to keep doing it and I'm going to do it at any cost, even if it's not the most financially viable.
Mm-hmm.
And that is right when I started my skate company, because I wanted to be in control of a brand. And I felt like, because skating was at such a lull, we could establish ourselves as one of the biggest brands at a time when the industry is very, very small.
Right.
So it was easy, not easy, but it was easier to break in to the skate industry and be a prominent player, because it didn't take a lot of capital.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
you get the back cover of the skate magazine mm-hmm. for $500.
Yeah, right. See, that's really interesting to me, because a lot of people would have just packed it in, said, oh, you know, it's a fad, it's done, boom, boom, got to find something else to do. But you saw it as an opportunity.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of faith in that it would come back around, and it mm-hmm. didn't come back around as quickly as we had hoped.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it allowed me to keep skating.
Yeah.
And that's all I really cared about.
What do you think was really the key to bringing it back big time? Was it X Games or what?
I think the X Games was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Skating went through a revolution in those early 90s when it was underground of street skating.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it reemerged, it was suddenly sort of a new sport where people mm-hmm. were watching it and they were saying, look at these guys going down these giant handrails and yeah. stairs and ledges. And they only knew it as these guys either skating pools or doing freestyle dances.
Yeah.
And so suddenly there was a whole new element and the world was your skate park. The downtown urban landscape was a place to actually go skate.
Yeah.
And that, the only reason that we did that is out of necessity, because all the skate parks were closed. Mm,
right. But, yeah.
But definitely like X Games, seeing it on TV yeah. suddenly, and then it was more of a counterculture, and you see it in commercials and things like yeah. that, and then that's what raised its profile for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. Stacy in the 80s was making his videos with Powell and did Animal Chin, and it seemed like that kind of opened the doors to like thrashing with Josh Brolin and
sure.
Gleaming the Cube with Christian Slater. I still don't know what the hell Gleaming the Cube that phrase means to you.
It was a thing that Neil Blender, who is this super creative skater, and he used to just throw terminology out there just for fun to mess with people.
So
and he
grand.
Said that in an interview at some point.
Yeah.
And whoever wrote that movie grabbed it, thought it was some skate term. Didn't mean anything.
It seems like a recurring theme that, you know, reading your book and you know, having done so many commercials over the years in Hollywood and having appeared in both of those movies, it seems like Hollywood consistently gets skateboarding wrong. What was the biggest misconception they got wrong about the skate culture, especially in the 80s? Because those movies are so dated now. When you look it back, you're like, come on.
Let's see. The biggest misconception, I think that it was more about the hairstyles
yeah.
and the music and the craziness mm-hmm. as opposed to the physical act of skating. And I think that's what got lost and maybe why it was so exploited mm-hmm. back then. Because people weren't really seeing the skaters themselves were seeing it. And there was a serious evolution of skating tricks happening back then.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly people just saw hairstyles and graphics and
mm-hmm.
and this sort of counterculture, you know, anti-establishment, and then
yeah.
it was like, ah, oh, those crazy kids, that's over.
Yeah, right. I mean, growing up in New York, I mean, you probably, maybe, well, you're a lot younger than me, but I mean, it was such a foreign concept. The skateboard, nobody skateboarded when I was
right.
growing up in the 60s, early 70s. I don't ever remember anyone having a skateboard in my neighborhood, you know.
Well, I grew up with
and it was
you,
always like a so. California thing, and it was like these kids out there in California, it was warm all the time, and people breaking into people's houses with pools that are drained, and you know, it was such
yeah,
a,
all of that led,
bizarre but, thing.
All of that led yeah. into it in
yeah.
terms of the attitude was just like, ah, those guys are too, they're too out there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. You know, question for you, because street, you know, I know that you know skating in the 70s kind of streamlined to basically freestyle and or rather street skating and vertical. Why is it hard for vertical skaters and street skaters to cross over? Is it just a completely different set of skills?
It can be, yeah. And especially if you're really focused on one or the other, there's a precision, say, to street skating and the sort of stuff you do with your board and grinding and things mm-hmm. that is not necessary on vert, mm-hmm. but also there's a precision to vert in terms of your angles and your flow and your and how high you go and the risk factor
yeah.
that is very different. So they are it's just I can't really I don't know how to make an analogy to something else. They're very different sets of skills for sure. Mm-hmm. Neither one is harder or easier, but you can just tell. Like, you can tell a vert skater on the street, they're kind of clunky. They can't get the big lift. They don't like flip their board as fast.
Yeah.
But if you take a street skater and you put them on a vert ramp, they don't know how to get up in the air and come back down correctly. Uh-huh. They're afraid to get to the top of the ramp.
Mm. That's interesting.
And that's where we live. Mm. You know, that's our comfort zone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it seems like if you're a gymnast, that would be great training for vertical skaters. Because you need that power in your thighs.
There have been a few. Well, so that's funny you say that. The one guy that, I mean, there's all kinds of folklore with 900s and people who are chasing it and whatnot. But the one guy that I thought was going to do it first was this guy, Rob Sluggo Boyce, because he was a gymnast.
Oh, interesting.
And he knew how to spin 2.5 times and land on his feet.
And had you heard stories?
He got close. There were about 5 of us chasing it for a couple of years before I did it. And he was the one that I was most convinced would make it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew. And when he would try it, you could see. He could spot his landing. He knew he had the air awareness.
Yeah.
And he never quite made it, but I felt like he got the closest for sure. And he was the first person to actually do a proper backflip on a vert ramp and come down and land properly.
Whoa.
So you're probably right, but there were no other examples of that.
Yeah. We were talking about the X Games before. What was your initial impressions of the games? Was it kind of like Hollywood movies and commercials? Guys aren't going to get this.
The first one was just a mishmash of weird sports and activities. So the first one they called Extreme Games.
Right.
And they were trying to package it, all of us together. So it was skateboarding, rollerblading, BMX, rock climbing, sky surfing, eco challenge. Like, none of these things had anything to do with the other. But yeah. And it was like, oh, you're an extreme athlete. No, I skateboard.
Right.
I don't rock climb. Like, what are you talking about? But they felt like they had to sort of package it all and present it to the public. And so there was a pretty harsh learning curve in the first few years where we were pretty defiant in terms of how they program their programming and what they were presenting.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we finally convinced them that, look, these are the ones that are shining through. Mm-hmm. These are the sports that are truly action sports, alternative, whatnot.
Yeah.
That aren't, you know, they had bungee jumping the first year.
Right. So random. They're just throwing darts.
Yeah.
At the wall,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And we did. But I felt like that's why, you know, a lot of skaters were turned off by that. I felt like we had an opportunity to present ourselves on a bigger venue than we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And we can shine through this noise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you had started Birdhouse a couple years before, and it was not an immediate success.
No.
A couple years where you're back to being on the road, sharing beds with 5 guys, you know, the guys who recruited for your team.
6 people to a hotel room.
Yeah. And ironically, really, it was the X Games that kind of vaulted you guys.
I would say by the second, third year of X Games, we finally started showing profit in Birdhouse, and it was very much connected to that exposure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you've been talking about the 900 since France in 1986, I think.
Let's see. The first time I tried it was, like 1988, maybe, in France, 89.
So what was the thing? I mean, you know, for the layman. I mean, the 900 is a 2.5.
You mean me?
Yeah. My boy Andy here.
The old guy at the table.
So it's basically the spinning move. The 540 was first done in 1984 by Mike McGill and McTwist. And then I learned the 720 the next year. So that's a double spin. Mm-hmm. And then the 900 was the milestone for that was much bigger because of the speed it takes and the technique of how you do it is you have to spin and you're blind to the landing twice because of that 2.5 spin.
Yeah.
All the other tricks, you're only blind to the landing once. And to commit to that is one thing. To find that landing is another thing, and to get the speed and to take the impact, it was just all kinds of elements to that. And that's why it was basically like a 10-year chase. And there were only a handful of us that were really following through with it.
Do you think with the technology of boards and what we know a little bit more about with aerodynamics and these half pipes and how we're, you know, get more speed, do you think that it'll be easier for people to
think it's only easier because people know it's been done.
Yeah.
I believe that, sure, there are all kinds of other things in place, that there are bigger ramps, there are foam pits, there are training facilities. But the fact that people know it's possible makes it so much easier to get to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there were, like I said, there was a handful of us that were trying it. Some of us were convinced maybe it's just not possible.
Mm.
Because we had given it our all to make it happen.
And it's something you can't really practice that much, right? Because
you get one day of trying to commit to it, and then you've got to rest for a few weeks for sure.
I just can't imagine. Well, to me, the most impressive thing about you accomplishing that feat was you did it in your last year as a pro, your 20th year as a pro. And the fact that most guys were retiring in their late teens, early 20s in your profession, the fact that you were doing this at 31, I mean, seems almost unheard of. I mean, it's like Kobe scoring 60 points in his last game.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know? Right. After, you know, tearing his Achilles like the year before, right?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Mean, I think figure that out.
There was also a misconception that, you know, you could have retired right after. You stuck it out for the rest of the year. But there was also a misconception that when you use the word retire, that we wouldn't see you ever again.
Right. Yeah, well, I think that was just more the mainstream mindset was, if you're not competing, you're retired.
Right. Mm.
But skateboarding is so much bigger than the competition series.
Yeah.
And it not competing allowed me to skate even more and in front of more people.
Right.
And improve my skills because I wasn't confined to this competitive mentality of trying to do the easiest, not the easiest, but the most consistent tricks. Mm-hmm. And then it allowed me to take more risks and take more chances and create other venues. Like, that's when I started the Boom Boom Huck Sham. We were doing all kinds of video game stuff, and I had way more fun in those few years after competing.
Well, speaking of that, 99 was a good year for you because that was when you linked up with Activision and you started
started the game a couple years prior, but having it be released in that year of 99 when suddenly I was recognized for my competition, that was the perfect storm of timing for sure.
Did you have any idea it would become this multi-billion-dollar entity?
No, not at all. if anything, I was just excited that they wanted to do a sequel.
Yeah.
To me, that was the gauge of success. They wanted to do a sequel. We made it.
That must have been amazing that you could have just like been playing the game and that was considered work.
Yeah.
You could be at home playing the game. And
yeah. It's funny you say that because I'm actually working on a mobile game right now, Tony Hawk Skate Jam. And I flew home from New York last night.
Yeah.
And that is what I was doing the entire time on the plane. And I'm sure people are looking at me like, oh, just playing video games the whole time. But I'm like,
this is business.
I'm doing combos and tricks and then taking notes of how to improve, how it looks. But hey, it's a job.
It's not only that, but another thing that's blowing my mind is that you went back and you did 50 of your tricks at age 50.
Oh, yeah.
You went back, which was, first of all, it freaked me out to see you fall the way you did.
Yeah, that was a bad...
On the 49th.
Yeah, that was not fun.
It goes back to our point. You must have, over the years, learned how to fall, even when you know you're going to wipe, just to protect yourself.
Sometimes you just got to take that risk that it might not work, you know, especially if it's in a competition format or whatnot. That particular day, I was just tired of trying 720s.
Yeah.
And so when I finally caught one and I felt the foot rotation good, I said, okay, this is it. I'm making this one. And then suddenly I looked up and I was off the edge of the ramp.
Well, where do you consider your pain threshold? I can't
unconscious?
Imagine.
Unconscious? I mean, what?
I don't know. I mean, look at the injuries you've had. I mean, you went a long time before you had this knee cartilage issue and had surgery on that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, how did you – I mean, there must be something about falling that you were able to
– Yeah, well,
self-preservation,
definitely in enduring pain, but also willing to put forth the effort to get better.
Yeah.
I think that some people like to – they don't like to, but they will use an injury as an excuse to prolong getting back in the game because they're afraid.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get back in as quickly as I could because I felt like that was my fastest way to heal and overcome any confidence issues that I had.
Mm-hmm.
But before that knee surgery, I had plenty of sprains and injuries and stitches and things like that. It was just that particular time was finally something physically was keeping me from doing what I could do.
Yeah.
Where my leg was pretty much stuck bent,
mm-hmm.
and I had to go get this cartilage removed so I could straighten it.
That's crazy. Is it back to normal, or will it ever be back to normal fully?
People say they say the whole thing, like, oh, I'm at 85%. I feel fine. I feel great for being 50. I think back to normal, like I feel like my my gauge of normal just changes with my age.
What do you do to stay in shape? Are you just doing skating 100% of the time for
mostly
exercise?
Mostly skating and surfing, yeah. Mm.
Surfing. Mm-hmm. Have you always been a surfer?
Yeah, since I started skating, actually. Because my brother was a surfer. That's he was my, you know, he was my muse.
Mm. Right. And he became a journalist, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, he was a journalist. He was working for Orange County Register, a newspaper,
yeah,
while being a very active surfer, and eventually became the editor of Surfer Magazine.
You have an amazingly talented family. I know your sister became your manager, right? And she was a backup singer for the Righteous Brothers.
She became my business partner. Well, that was a natural progression because she was a backup singer, yeah, and she had a lot of success in the entertainment industry. She sang backup for John Denver and for
Michael
Medley
Bolton.
And Righteous Brothers and Pet Shop Boys. And
whoa.
And but she got pregnant and couldn't tour anymore because she was at a high-risk pregnancy. Mm. And when she stopped touring, she saw my career starting to take off into the entertainment sector for the most part. Mm-hmm. And she said, hey, I could help you navigate this because I know what this is all about, doing shows. Mm. And then she became my business manager and partner then because she wanted to stay home. And she very much knew how to speak that language.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, by the time you finished your career, you had, you know, 103, I think you won 73 out of 103 contests. I know awards are not something that are a thing for you. What do you consider over your career the thing you're most proud of? I mean, the Tony Hawk Foundation is pretty remarkable what you've done. Can you...
Absolutely. I think, well, for sure, I'm most proud of helping to create these facilities, especially in low-income areas, at the public skate parks.
Yeah, can you talk a little about that? Because you've raised millions of dollars for these communities.
Yeah, well, this foundation's been around for 16 years.
Yeah.
And we've helped to fund almost 700 skate parks now.
Wow.
Given away about $7 million in the process.
All in the U.S.? All here?
Most in the U.S. We also have a partnership with Skatistan, so we've helped them fund some facilities in South Africa and Cambodia, and we're going to help them with one in Jordan coming up soon.
Wow.
Their model's insane. I mean, I trust them implicitly, but but for our mostly in the U.S. And that was just in reaction to seeing skateboarding grow in popularity and not seeing the amount of facilities that would cater to the amount of skaters there were. There just weren't enough facilities, and the ones that were being built were in affluent areas, and generally they were designed poorly, and I wanted to sort of direct that funding to where the more needy areas and to get the kids involved in the design process. So for sure, in terms of whatever I leave behind, a legacy, the foundation is hugely important to me, but I think I'm more proud of just making a career of skateboarding as a grown-ass adult.
Right. It's a dream. Right?
Yeah, I never imagined. Well, and people say, like, well, is this what you imagined? We never had anything to compare to.
Yeah.
And you're still creating new tricks. This downward spiral thing, by the way, is unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, well, that was a one-trick pony, but I'm not doing that one again.
You know, I think about that, though, and it makes me think about Jackass, and it makes me think about just how skateboarding expanded the culture so much into mainstream. It was such a subculture when you started. I mean, Jackass was a skateboard magazine. It was these guys who were basically doing what you guys were doing in Peralta's videos. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, that became like the thing.
Yeah,
Is skateboarding today in a good place? I can look at this kid, Tom Schar, his 12-year-old, who just did the 1080.
Yeah, well, he's almost 20 now.
When he was 12, he did.
He did, absolutely. I mean, I think it's in a great place. There's so much support and there's so much more embracing from the general public of skateboarding. Skateboarding is just part of our culture now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very much, but it's still very, very much considered edgy. You know, it's connected with hip hop. It's connected with fashion. So I think it's in a great place in terms of its perception. It's going to be growing internationally thanks to the inclusion of the Olympics.
Yeah.
To have a skateboard company is a huge challenge because the it's so diluted. It used to be just a few big companies, and they were the ones that were calling the shots. And now, with the age of the internet and the diversity of skating, it's very difficult to stay in business as a skate company. So the industry struggles, but I feel like the world of skateboarding as a whole is in a good place.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we have a very good mutual friend, of course, Atiba Jefferson.
Yeah. I think he's been texting me throughout this whole interview. Buzzing.
Tell him to shut up. Come on, we're not done.
Yeah.
We're almost done. But just in a nutshell, Tony, tell how you met Atiba. He's the most unique person I think I've ever met. And, you know, the guy just transcends all different kinds of stuff, from skating to business basketball. To photography to basketball. One of my great friends. I mean, how did you guys meet in the first place?
How do we meet? We met when he moved to California to chase the dream of being in the skate industry. Mm-hmm. He and his twin brother, Akko.
Right.
And we went on a skate tour with our Birdhouse team in 92. And Atiba came with us as the resident photographer.
Yeah.
And helped me to organize the tour, to babysit. I mean, you know, I was wearing every hat back then.
Yeah.
And Atiba was very much in the mix with me, not just being a photographer, but he became one of the most prolific photographers.
Unbelievable.
I mean, you know, his stuff is so iconic and it's so recognizable. And some of his photos throughout these years, I mean, Grant was his mentor, Grant Britton, who I used to shoot with.
Yeah.
But for instance, you're showing me all these photos right here.
These are all his photos of you.
Yeah, that were on covers and stuff like that. This one in particular is a picture of me and Andy McDonald where we're doing a hand plant. He's doing a hand plant and I'm doing a hand plant on top of his.
That is a crazy
picture.
Cool.
We're
posting this, by the way, folks.
Andy presented this idea to me, and we knew we were capable of doing it. But he kept asking me, like, we got to get a photo. And I kept ignoring his calls because I just know this was going to take a lot out of me to do it.
Because
I'm the one on top, by the way. I had the most risk. And I finally called him back and I said, okay, Andy, I will do it only if Atiba shoots it.
And it's in a one-shot deal, right? I mean, you're not doing this like 8 times and he's going to get one shot, right?
We tried it about a dozen times. We made one. I don't know if this is the one we made, but we got into it enough that we got the photo. Let's put it that way. That's the dirty secret of skateboarding.
Yeah.
You'll try it a million times. You might get a really good photo, but that photo might not be the one you made.
That's really
it looks
great.
Like you made
that.
It from what I could
tell. We did make it. I don't know if it's that exact one.
He's your favorite doubles partner, it seems like. You did a lot of doubles and
I trust him with my life. Absolutely. Yes.
And that was a great example. I feel like the X Games tried to pit you two. I mean, what we started talking about, like, that was their whole thing. They wanted to pit a rivalry and they tried to pit you against each other. And you guys were like, dude, we're friends.
They needed their story. You know, they needed their,
there's one story you have to tell about after you did The End, which I know you're really proud of, the movie you did for Birdhouse. And about a month after, you were going to like Ruth Chris Steakhouse with Atiba, Sean, Heath, a few of your buddies.
Oh,
and the van was on fire.
Oh, those guys. Well, so basically, Jeremy Klein was our creative director for Birdhouse, and we were all close friends with Atiba and whatnot.
Yeah.
And Jeremy was he loved chaos. And so he and Heath Kirchhart were two of our writers. Their part in The End is the craziest. They ended up doing their own video called Hookups, Destroying America. That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
And so when they said, hey, you want to go to dinner with us? We'll pick you up in the van. I knew something was up. And they're like lighting fires in the van. They're driving over islands and like dropping down parking lots. And it was chaos. It was very scary.
Yeah.
And inappropriate for the most part. But then we walked into Ruth Chris. And people literally said, as walked by, like, did you guys just go to a campfire?
Marshmallows, like, toasted?
Yeah. No, we just survived a fire inside the van that they started.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And then the cops pulled you over at some point?
Cops pulled us over, and they were just about to jump the van down a level of a parking lot. And we said we were shooting skate photos.
Oh, my God.
And that was probably the first time that we ever said we were skating that got us out of trouble.
That's crazy.
So, Tony, what's next? You talked about an app that's coming out? That's,
yeah,
that's
Tony Hawk Skate Jam's mobile game we're working on right now. We're going to be done, I think, next month.
All right.
The app be out, and I'm working on a Broadway project with Mark Mothersbaugh.
Come on.
Whoa, very cool. Devo, Mark Mothersbaugh.
Are we the first ones
Mark
to hear?
Mark Mothersbaugh and Nick Hornby. We bought the rights to Nick Hornby book. And
wow.
Yeah.
That is going to be amazing.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Wow.
Do you think we'll see a Tony Hawk movie at some point?
I don't know.
I mean, especially after they've screwed up so many of these movies. Yeah.
I actually, Disney bought an option to my biography a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they said they were going to make it, and then we got caught in licensing rights with products because they wanted to make everything with my name on it, which already existed.
Yeah.
And the deal got lost. It was weird.
Well, also, if you haven't read Hawk, Occupation Skateboard.
That was the book.
This is it.
Yeah.
New York Times bestseller. It's a fantastic book. Great read. And really, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is
Thanks
fantastic.
For having me.
Such
fun.
A treat.
Tony, thank you so much, really. Because
sure.
it brought me into a world that I really am fascinated by. I just didn't know enough about. And having known Atiba for so long and Akko and kind of living vicariously through them, and just great to meet you and great to have you part
of
Legends
of Sport.
Oh, you
too. Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm glad it worked out.
All That's right, great. Man. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for continuing to download and subscribe to our podcast. Remember, you can find us on the iHeart app and online, as well as Apple and Spotify and your favorite podcast platform. Keep following us on Instagram at Legends of Sport, our Twitter at Legends_of Sport, our website, legendsofsport.net, and our YouTube and TikTok channels, Legends of Sport. My photography can be found on Instagram and Twitter at ADB Photo Inc. So, folks, we'll be back next week with another great episode. You know that. But until then, stay safe and stay well.